top-head skeletons, tweaked and sunrise and the English beat, cleansing their systems and their acne with cutbacks and bumpy floaters on the mushy breaks. But no matter where you surf, motherfuckers hog the sandbar. The west end of Rosencrantz Avenue, where the street dead ends with the sand, is the 42nd parallel between the kickback and uptight hemispheres of the L.A. County coastline. From Manhattan Beach down to Cabrillo, they called you nigger and expected you to run. El Porto, north to Santa Monica, they called you nigger and expected you to fight. Malibu and beyond, they called the police. I started to take the bus farther and farther up the coast so that I could spend more time chatting up Marpessa. We hadn't really seen each other since she started dating older boys and stopped hanging out at Hominy's. After 2 hours of swapping stories about slum life in Dickens and what Hominy was up to, I'd find myself miles from home, surfing with seals and dolphins at increasingly remote spots like Topanga, Las Tunas, Amarillo, Blocker, Escondido, and Zuma, drifting onto private beachfronts where, soaking wet, the billionaire locals would stare at me as if I were a talking walrus with a willow tree afro when I'd walk through their sandy backyards, knock on the glass sliding doors, and ask to use the phone in the bathroom. But for some reason, non-surfing white folk trust a barefoot nigger carrying a board. Maybe they thought to themselves, his arms are too full to make off with the TV, and besides, where is he gonna run to? After a springtime's worth of weekend surfing, Marpessa trusted me enough to accompany me to my high school prom. With a graduating class of one, it was an intimate two-person affair, chaperoned and chauffeured by my father. We went dancing at Dylan's, an under-21 pagoda tower of a disco as segregated as anything else in L.A. The first floor, new wave. Second floor, top 40 soul. Third floor, watered-down reggae. Fourth floor, banda, salsa, merengue, and a touch of bachata, in a vain attempt to steal Latino clientele from Florentine Gardens on Hollywood Boulevard. My father refused to go above the second floor. Me and Marpessa took the opportunity to ditch him, hiking up the smelly stairwell to the third floor where we shimmied to Jimmy Cliff and the I-3s, and camped out in back behind speakers, downing Mai Tais and standing as close to Christy McNichol's crew as possible so that security wouldn't fuck with us, thinking we were the teenage movie star's token black friends. Then it was on to Coconut Teasers to see the Bangles, where Marpessa slurred whispered rumors that some guy named Prince was fucking the lead singer. My ignorance of his royal badness almost got my ass kicked, and nearly postponed my first kiss until who knows when, but an early morning Denny's Grand Slam breakfast later, we were in the back of the pickup, speeding down the 10 freeway, doing 80 miles per hour in the fast lane, using the bags of feed and seed for pillows as we alternated wrestling with our tongues and thumbs. Played who can hit the softest. Kissed. Puked. Then kissed again. "Don't say French," she cautioned. "Say swap spit or bust a slob. Otherwise you sound inexperienced." My father, instead of keeping his eyes on the road, kept turning around, peering noisily through the little cab window, rolling his eyes at my breast-fondling technique, mocking the spastic way my head lolled uncontrollably when I kiss, and making the universal sign for fucker already by taking his hands off the wheel, forming a circular vagina with one hand, and sticking his index finger into it over and over again. For a man whose only evidence that he'd ever had sex with someone not enrolled in his class is possibly me, he sure was talking a lot of shit. Between the bus and rides, the back of the pickup, the trips on horseback to the Baldwin Theater, it's crazy how much of our relationship was spent in motion. Marpessa put her feet on the steering wheel and covered her face in a tattered copy of Kafka's The Trial. Though I can't say for sure, I'd like to think she was hiding a smile. Most couples have songs they call their own. We had books, authors, artists, silent movies. On weekends, we used to lie naked in the hayloft, flicking chicken feathers off one another's back and leafing through L.A. Weekly. There'd be a retrospective of Gerhard Richter, David Hammonds, Elizabeth Murray, or Basquiat at LACMA. And we'd tap the ad and say, "Hey, they're exhibiting our oil on canvas." We'd spend hours picking through the used film bins at Amoeba Records on Sunset, hold up a copy of Eric Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front, and say, "Hey, they're digitally remastering our movie." Then dry hump in the Hong Kong movie section. But Kafka was our genius. We'd take turns reading America and Parables out loud. Sometimes we'd read the books in incomprehensible German and do free association translations. Sometimes we'd set the text to music and breakdance to the Metamorphosis, slow dance to Letters to Milena. Remember how you used to say I reminded you of Kafka? Just because you burned some of your shitty poems doesn't mean I thought you were anything like Kafka. People tried to stop Kafka from destroying his work. I struck the matches for you.
Touché.
The doors opened, and the salty smell of the ocean, oil deposits, and seagull droppings wafted into the bus. I hesitated at the bottom stair, fumbling with the board like I was having trouble getting it through the doors.
How's Hominy?
He's all right. Tried to kill himself a while back.
He's so fucking crazy.
Yeah, still is. You know, his birthday is coming up. I got an idea you can help me with.
Marpessa leaned back and rested her book on a second trimester-sized paunch.
Are you pregnant?
Bon-bon, don't play yourself.
Mad as she was at me, I couldn't stop smiling because I couldn't remember the last time she'd called me Bon-bon. While not the roughest sobriquet, it's the closest thing I've ever had to a street name. When I was young, I had a reputation for being extremely lucky. I never suffered from the typical ghetto maladies. I was never baby shook, never contracted rickets, ringworm, sickle cell trait, lockjaw, early onset diabetes, or the itis. Hoodlums would jump my friends but leave me alone. The cops somehow never got around to putting my name on a scare card or my neck in a chokehold. I never had to live in the car for a week. No one ever mistook me for that punk who shot, raped, snitched on, impregnated, molested, welched, disrespected, neglected, or fucked over somebody's peoples. Rabbit's Foot, Star Child, Four-Leaf Lucky Motherfucker. None of the nicknames stuck until, at 11 years old, I was involuntarily entered by my father in a citywide spelling bee sponsored by the now-defunct Dickens Bulletin, a paper so black the newsprint ink color scheme was reversed, as in, "Honky City Council approves budget increase." Black background, white text. The finals pitted me against Nikisha Raymond. Her word was ampelosepsis. Mine was bonbon. And after that, up until the night my father died, it was bonbon, pick my numbers. Bonbon, blow on my dice. Bonbon, take my civil service exam for me. Bonbon, kiss my baby. Yeah, since Pops got popped, people tend to keep their distance.
Bonbon?
Marpessa squeezed her hands together to stop them from shaking.
I'm sorry about the way I treated you earlier. This fucking job.
Sometimes I think that there's no such thing as measurable intelligence, and that, if there is, it definitely isn't a predictor of anything, especially for colored people. Maybe morons can't become brain surgeons, but a genius can be either a cardiologist or a postal clerk or a bus driver. A bus driver who made some fucked up choices, never put down the books, but after our brief relationship, fell for an abusive, old school, then wannabe gangster rapper who dragged her out by her half-done hair in the mornings and, while she was still in her footy pajamas, forced her to case jewelry stores in the valley. I never could figure why the places didn't call the police immediately upon seeing a young African-American female suspect walk dead into the middle of the store exactly 10 minutes after opening time, stare directly at the security guards and the cameras, while counting her steps out loud as she paced off the distance between the diamond rings and brooches. Eyes blackened, she'd show up at my place, skulking in the shadows, like a film noir villainess wanted for overacting and underappreciating her self-worth. College wasn't for her, because to her mind, the workplace turns black women into indispensable, well-paid number threes and fours, but never ones or twos. Sometimes getting pregnant early in life is a good thing. It slaps you to attention, straightens your posture. Marpessa stood at the back door, eating a peach she'd pulled off the tree. The blood from her nose and lip mingled with the nectar, dripped down her chin and onto her shirt and once spotless sneakers. The sun behind her turning the edges of her frizzy, undone hair into a flaming corona of split ends and shame. She wouldn't come inside. She'd only say, "My water broke," which of course broke my heart. A maniacal drive and an epidural later, Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital, a.k.a. Killer King, got one right. A child, middle name Bonbon, a milk-guzzling, nipple-gnawing terror who serves as your incentive to apply for a Class B driver's license, reminds you that next to Kafka, Gwendolyn Brooks, Einstein, and Tolstoy, your favorite thing is to drive, is to keep moving. To guide your bus and your life gently and slowly into the terminus and take a well-deserved respite. So, you gonna help out with Harmony? Just get the fuck off the bus. With a push of the ignition button, the bus growled to life. Marpessa was next to go. She shut the door in my face, but slowly. You know, it was me that painted that line around Dickens. I heard some shit about that. But why? I'm bringing the city back. Bringing you back, too. Good luck with that. Bouncing up and down Ocean Avenue in the back of a shitbox pickup truck with some shaggy aboriginal blonde-haired white boys damn near as dark as you, their sun-baked faces peeling like the old Local Motion bumper stickers affixed to the tailgate. Sometimes you feel more like a surfer than you do when you're bellied atop your board, staring into the misty horizon waiting for the next set. Kind enough to offer you a ride, you return the favor with smoke, puffing and passing, and trying to keep your stick from getting dinged up with every California pothole hit and high as hell. Whoa, dude, is it me or are the caution lights getting shorter? Sudden stop. Incredible bud, dude. Where'd you get this shit? I know some Dutch coffee shop owners. Chapter 10. That wintry day in the segregated state of Alabama, when Rosa Parks refused to give up her bus seat to a white man, she became known as the mother of the modern-day civil rights movement. Decades later, on a seasonally indeterminate afternoon in a supposedly unsegregated section of Los Angeles, California, Hominy Jenkins couldn't wait to give up his seat to a white person. Grandfather of the post-racial civil rights movement known as the Standstill, he sat in the front of the bus, on the edge of his aisle seat, giving each new rider the once-over. Unfortunately for him, Dickens is a community as black as Asian hair, as brown as James, and after 45 minutes of standing room only, all minority ridership. The closest he got to a white person was the dreadlocked woman who got on at Poinsettia Avenue, toting a rolled-up yoga mat. "Happy birthday, Hominy," she said gaily, standing over him, her face dripping Bikram sweat onto his shirt sleeve. "How does everyone know it's my birthday?" "It says so, on the front of the bus. Big bright lights. Bus number 125. Happy birthday, Hominy. Yowza like a motherfucker."
"Oh.
Did you get anything good for your birthday?"
Hominy pointed to the blue and white cigarette box-sized signs stickered under the windows that lined the front third of the bus. Priority seating for seniors, disabled, and whites.
Personas mayores, incapacitados, y cueros tienen prioridad de asiento. That's my birthday present. Dickens used to celebrate Hominy's birthday as a collective. Not that there were parades and key to the city accolades, but people would congregate outside his home, chanting, Yowza, and armed with eggs, pea shooters, and meringue pies. They'd take turns ringing the doorbell, and when he answered, they'd shout, Happy birthday, Hominy, and hurl pastries and chicken ovum at his shiny black face. Ecstatic, he'd wipe himself clean, change clothes, and prepare himself for the next celebratory band of well-wishers. But when the city disappeared, so did the birthday tradition. It became just me knocking on his door and asking Hominy what he wanted for his birthday this year. His answer was always the same. I don't know. Just get me some racism and I'll be straight. Then he'd look to see if I was hiding a rotten tomato or a sack of flour behind my back. Some boys come round here and smush tomatoes in your face? Usually, I'd buy him some black Americana tchotchke. Two porcelain banjo-playing pickaninnies picking tunes underneath the wisteria tree, an Obama sock monkey, or a pair of eyeglasses that invariably slide down the bridges of African-American and Asian noses. But when I'd noticed that Hominy and Rodney Glenn King shared the same birthday, April 2nd, it dawned on me that if places like Sedona, Arizona have energy vortexes, mystical holy lands where visitors experience rejuvenation and spiritual awakenings, Los Angeles must have racism vortexes. Spots where visitors experience deep feelings of melancholy and ethnic worthlessness. Places like the breakdown lane on the Foothill Freeway, where Rodney King's life, and in a sense America and its haughty notions of fair play, began their downward spirals. Racial vortices like the intersection of Florence and Normandy, where misbegotten trucker Reginald Denny caught a cinder block, a 40-ounce, and fucking centuries of frustration to the face. Chavez Ravine, where a generations-old Mexican-American neighborhood was torn down, its residents forcibly removed, beaten, and left uncompensated to make room for a baseball stadium with ample parking and the Dodger dog. 7th Street, between Mesa and Center, is the vortex where in 1942, a long line of buses idled as Japanese Americans began the first step toward mass incarceration. And where would Hominy be most happy but on the number 125 bus rolling through Dickens, a racial vortex unto itself? His seat on the right-hand side, 3 rows from the front door, the spinning epicenter of racism. The signs were such good replicas, most people didn't notice the difference, and even after you read them, your comprehension tricked you into thinking the sign said what they'd always said, priority seating for seniors and the disabled. And although it was the first, the yogi's complaint wouldn't be the only one Marpessa fielded that day. Once the black cat was out of the bag, all shift long the passengers bitched and moaned, pointed to the stickers and shook their heads. Not so much from disbelief that the city had the nerve to reinstitute public segregation, but that it had taken so long to do so. The complimentary slices of Baskin-Robbins Oreo cookie cake, the airplane jiggers of J&B Brandy, and her blasé disclaimer. It's Los Angeles, the most racist city in the world. What the fuck you gonna do? Only went so far in assuaging their anger. That's some bullshit, a man shouted before asking for more cake and drink. And to be perfectly frank, I'm offended. What does that mean, I'm offended? I asked the unrequited love of my life, talking to her through the panoramic rearview mirror. It hadn't been hard to convince Marpesa to convert the number 125 bus into a rolling party center. She loved Hominy as much as I did. And a promised first edition of Baldwin's Giovanni's Room didn't hurt either. It's not even an emotion. What does being offended say about how you feel? No great theater director ever said to an actor, Okay, this scene calls for some real emotion. Now go out there and give me lots of offendedness. Marpesa worked the stick shift knob with her fingerless, leather-gloved hand with such forceful dexterity, I found myself fidgeting in my seat. That's saying a lot, coming from a callow farm boy who's never been offended in his life because his head's too high in the clouds. That's because if I ever were to be offended, I wouldn't know what to do. If I'm sad, I cry. If I'm happy, I laugh. If I'm offended, what do I do? State in a clear and sober voice that I'm offended, then walk away in a huff so that I can write a letter to the mayor?
You're a sick fuck. And those damn signs you made have fucking set black people back 500 years.
And another thing, how come you never hear anyone say, wow, you've pushed black people ahead 500 years? How come no one ever says that?
You know what you are? A fucking race pervert.
Crawling through people's backyards and smelling their dirty laundry, while you jack off cross-dressed as a fucking white man. It's the goddamn 21st century. People died so I could get this job, and I let your sick ass talk me into driving a segregated bus. Correction. It's the 26th century, because as of today, I've set black people 500 years ahead of everybody else on the planet. And besides, look how happy Hominy is.
Marpessa glanced up at the mirror and snuck a peek at the birthday boy.
He doesn't look happy. He looks constipated.
She was right. Hominy didn't necessarily look happy, but neither do motorcycle daredevils standing atop 50-foot-high jump ramps, revving their engines and staring out at the desert expanse and precipitous drop that is Gila Monster Canyon.
Yet as he stood on the lookout for one of his Caucasian betters, gripping the seat back in front of him, nervously scanning his surroundings like some suicidal gazelle looking over the Serengeti for a jungle cat to whom he could sacrifice himself, one has to understand that death-defying feats are their own reward. And of course, when a rare white lioness boarded the bus at Avalon Boulevard and dropped her exact change in the fare box, coin by carefully counted out coin, Hominy, the skittish nigger gazelle, was looking in the wrong direction, oblivious to the signals from the rest of the herd that a predator was on board. The hushed silence, the raised eyebrows, the wrinkled noses. When he finally did catch the woman's scent, it was almost too late. She hovered over him, stalking her prey from behind an elephantine man dressed from head to toe in basketball gear and reading a sports magazine. Eventually, the aging early warning system inside Hominy's nappy head screamed, "Look out! A white bitch!" And he snapped to yes ma'am attention. And without being asked or ordered, Hominy relinquished his seat in a manner so obsequious, so unctuously negro, that the act was less an offer of his place than a bequeathal. Because to him, that seat, as hard and plastic and orange-brown as it was her birthright, and his gesture was a tribute, a long-overdue payment to the gods of white superiority. If he could have figured out a way to stand up on bended knee, he would have. If a smile is just a frown turned upside down, then the look of contentment on Hominy's face as he shuffled to the back of the bus was a pout turned inside out. I think that, in part, it's why no one protested his actions. We recognized the face he was wearing as a mask from our own collections. The happy mask we carry in our back pockets, and like bank robbers whip out when we want to steal some privacy or make an emotional getaway. It took all my self-control not to beg the woman to do me the honor of sitting in my seat. Sometimes I think that inert, cigar-store Indian wooden smirk is the result of natural selection. That it's survival of the witless. And we're the black moths in that classic evolution photo, clinging to the dark, soot-covered tree, invisible to our predators, and yet somehow still vulnerable. The job of the swarthy moth is to keep the white moth occupied. Glued to the tree with bad poetry, jazz, and corny stand-up routines about the difference between white moths and black moths. Why do white moths always be flying toward lights, slamming into screen doors and shit? You never see black moths do that, stupid fluttering motherfuckers. Anything to keep the white moth next to us, and thereby reducing our chances of being targets for birds of prey,
the Volunteer Army, or Cirque du Soleil. It always bothered me that in those photos, the white moth was invariably higher up the tree trunk. What were those textbooks trying to imply? That despite supposedly being more at risk, the white moth was still higher up the evolutionary and social ladder? Regardless, I suppose that black moth wore the same face hominy did, that subservient countenance inherent in all black Lepidoptera and people, that autonomic, eager-to-please response that's triggered any time you're approached in a store and asked, "Do you work here?" The face worn every moment you're on the job and not in the bathroom stall. The face flashed to the white person who saunters by and patronizingly pats you on the shoulder and says, "You're doing a fine job. Keep up the good work." The face that feigns acknowledgement that the better man got the promotion, even though deep down you and they both know that you really are the better man, and that the best man is the woman on the second floor. So when Hominy, the stoop-shouldered epitome of obsequiousness, stood up and made that face, everyone on board felt like they, too, had a white person next to them baring their forearms and wanting to compare tans after they've returned from a Caribbean vacation. Felt like Asians being asked, "No, where are you from originally?" Like Latinos being asked for proof of residency and big-chested women being asked, "So are those real?" It wasn't until Marpessa noticed that the unknown white woman completed the 3-hour round trip from El Segundo Plaza to Norwalk and back again that she began to get suspicious. But by then, it was too late. The bus was nearly empty, and her shift was almost over. "You know her, don't you?" "No, I don't." "And I don't believe you." Marpessa popped her gum and picked up the in-dash microphone, filling the bus with amplified derision. "Miss, excuse me. Would the lady with the strawberry blonde hair who was preternaturally comfortable with a literal busload of niggers and Mexicans, and by Mexicans I mean all people, Central, South, North, and whatever Americas have you, native-born and otherwise, please approach the front of the bus. Thank you." The dusk lowered itself onto El Puerto Harbor, and as the white woman sauntered down the aisle, the sunlight decanted itself through the front windshield and into the bus in blinding streaks of overlapping purple and orange hues, lighting her up like a beauty pageant winner. I hadn't noticed how pretty she was. Too pretty. It wouldn't be hard to argue that Hominy gave up his seat, not because she was white, but because she was so fucking fine. And that notion had me reassessing the entire civil rights movement. Maybe race had nothing to do with it. Maybe Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat because she knew the guy to be unapologetically gassy, or one of those annoying people who insist on asking what you're reading, then without prompting tells you what he's reading, what he wants to read, what he regrets having read, what he tells people he's read but really hasn't read. So like those high school white girls who have after-school sex with the burly black athlete in the woodshop and then cry rape when their fathers find out, maybe Rosa Parks, after the arrest, the endless church rallies, and all the press, had to cry racism, because what was she gonna say? "I refused to move because the man asked me what I was reading." Negroes would have lynched her. Marpessa looked at me, then at her lone white passenger, then back at me, and stopped the bus in the middle of a busy intersection, flinging open the doors with all the civil servant courtesy she could muster. "Everybody who I don't know personally, get the fuck off the bus." Everybody being a lazy skateboarder and two kids who'd spent the past hour necking like twisted rubber bands in the back, who quickly found themselves in the middle of Rosecrans Avenue holding free transfer tickets that flapped uselessly in the sea breeze. Miss Freedom Rider was about to join them when Marpessa blocked her passage like Governor Wallace blocked the entrance to the University of Alabama in 1963. "In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." "What's your name?" Marpessa asked as she cajoled the bus northbound onto Las Mesas.
Laura Jane?
Well, Laura Jane, I don't know how you know this fertilizer-smelling fool right here, but I hope you like to party. Unlike those expensive, staid, day-trip excursions to Catalina Island, the impromptu four-wheel birthday party cruise up the Pacific Coast Highway was free and jumping like a motherfucker. Our highway next to the ocean liner had all the amenities. Open bar, stomped-on aluminum can, whisk broom shuffleboard, casino gambling, which consisted of pitching pennies, dominoes, a coin flip game called Get Like Me, and a disco lounge. Captain Marpesa womaned the helm, drinking and cursing like a pissed-off pirate. I filled in as first mate, purser, deckhand, bartender, and DJ. We picked up some more passengers on the way when the bus pulled into the Jack-in-the-Box drive-thru across the street from Malibu Pier, cranking Houdini's 5 minutes of funk. And when we ordered 50 tacos and a shitload of sauce, the entire night shift quit on the spot and climbed aboard, aprons, paper hats, and all. If I had pen and paper and the bus had a bathroom, I would have posted another sign. All employees must wash their hands and their minds before returning to their lives. After night falls, once past Pepperdine University, where the highway narrows into a two-lane hill that stretches like a skate ramp to the stars, there isn't much light. Just the occasional flash of oncoming high beams, and if you're lucky, a lonely bonfire on the sand and the sheets of moonlight give the Pacific Ocean a glassy black obsidian sheen. It was on the same stretch of winding road that I first courted Marpesa. I bussed her on the cheek. She didn't flinch, which I interpreted as a good sign. Although the bus cruise was bumping, Hominy had spent most of the ride standing in the middle of the dance floor, stubbornly holding on to the overhead bar and, by proxy, the history of American discrimination. But around Puerco Beach, Laura Jane had managed to coax him out of his ancient mindset by grinding her pelvic bone rhythmically against his backside and playing with his ears. Freaking, we used to call it. And she pranced around Hominy, her hands overhead, caressing the beat. When the song ended, she shouldered her way toward the bow, the fuzz on her upper lip beaded with sweat. God damn, she was fine.
Wicked party?
The radio buzzed to life, and a dispatcher said the words, "Whereabouts?" in a concerned voice. Marpesa turned down the music, said something I couldn't hear, then blew a kiss into the receiver and switched off the radio. If New York is the city that never sleeps, then Los Angeles is the city that's always passed out on the couch. Once past Leo Carrillo, PCH begins to smooth out, and when the moon disappears behind the Santa Monica Mountains, painting the night sky pitch black, if you listen closely, you can hear two faint pops in fairly quick succession. The first is the sound of 4 million living room television sets flickering off in unison, and the second is the sound of 4 million bedroom ones being powered on. Movie makers and photographers often speak of the uniqueness of L.A. sunlight, the ways it pours itself across the sky, golden and sweet, like Vermeer, Monet, and breakfast honey all rolled into one. But the L.A. moonlight, or lack thereof, rather, is just as special. When night falls, I mean really falls, the temperature drops 20 degrees, and a total amniotic blackness blankets and comforts you like a lover making the bed while you're still in it. And that brief moment between television sets popping off and back on is the calm before the after-hours strip clubs in Inglewood open, before the cacophony of New Year's Eve gunshots rings out, before Santa Monica, Hollywood, Whittier, and Crenshaw Boulevards come slowly cruising to life, is when Angelenos take time to pause and reflect, to give thanks to the late-night joints in Koreatown, to Mariachi Square, to chili burgers and pastrami dip sandwiches, to Marpesa, peering through the windshield and squinting at the stars, driving by dead reckoning rather than simply following the road. The tires ground assuredly over the asphalt, the bus rolling through the stratosphere, and when she heard the second pop, Marpesa gave the go-ahead for more music. And before long, Hominy and the rest of the Jack-in-the-Box ballet were again pirouetting in the aisle, singing out loud to Tom Petty. "Where'd he find you?" Marpessa asked Laura Jane, her eyes still fixed on the Milky Way.
"He hired me."
"You a prostitute?"
"Damn near. Actress. Part-time submissive to pay the bills."
"Parts must be hard to come by if you have to do this shit." Marpessa cut her eyes at Laura Jane, bit her bottom lip, and turned her attention back to the celestial night. "Have I ever seen you in anything?"
"I do mostly television commercials, but it's tough. Whenever I'm up for a part, the producers look at me like you just did and say, 'Not suburban enough,' which in the industry is code for 'too Jewish.'"
Sensing that Marpessa hadn't quite cleared her chakras during her L.A. moment of silence, Laura Jane pressed her pretty face cheek to cheek with Marpessa's jealous mug, and together they studied themselves in the rearview mirror, looking like a pair of mismatched conjoined twins attached at the head. One middle-aged and black, the other young and white, sharing the same brain, but not the same thought process.
"Makes me wish I was black,"
the white twin said, smiling and running her hands over her darker sister's burning cheeks.
"Black people get all the jobs."
Marpessa must have put the bus on autopilot, because her hands were off the steering wheel and around Laura Jane's neck, not choking her, but pointedly straightening the collar of her dress, letting her evil twin know she was ready to pounce as soon as her side of the brain gave the okay.
"Look, I doubt that black people get all the jobs. But even if they do, it's because Madison Avenue knows niggas spend $1.20 of every dollar they earn on the crap they see on television. Let's take the standard luxury car commercial."
Laura Jane nodded as if she were really listening, slyly slipping her arms around Marpessa and onto the steering wheel. For a second, we veered across the double yellow lines, but she made a deft correction and gently guided the bus back into the passing lane.
"Luxury cars, you were saying?" "The subtle message of the luxury car commercial is, we here at Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Lexus, Cadillac, or whatever the fuck, are an equal opportunity opportunist. See this handsome African-American male model behind the wheel? We'd like you, oh holy, highly sought-after white male consumer, between the ages of 30 and 45, sitting in your recliner, we'd like you to spend your money and join our happy, carefree, prejudice-free world. A world where black men drive, sitting straight up in their seats, and not sunk so low and to the side you can see only the tops of their gleaming, ball-peen heads." "And what's so wrong with that?"
"But the subliminal message is, look, you lazy, fat, susceptible to marketing poor excuse for a white man. You've indulged this 30-second fantasy of a nigger dandy commuting from his Tudor castle in an aerodynamically designed piece of precision German engineering. So you'd better get your act together, bro, and stop letting these rack-and-pinion-steering moonroof manufacturers' suggested retail price-paying monkeys show you up and steal your piece of the American dream." At mention of the American dream, Laura Jane stiffened and returned the con to Marpessa.
"I'm offended," she said.
"Because I use the word nigger?"
"No, because you're a beautiful woman who just happens to be black, and you're far too smart not to know that it isn't race that's the problem, but class."
Laura Jane planted a loud, wet smack on Marpessa's forehead and spun on her Louboutin heels to go back to work. I grabbed my love's arm in mid-swing, saving Laura Jane from a rabbit punch she never saw coming.
"You know why white people don't ever just happen to be white? Because they all think they've just happened to have been touched by God. That's why."
I thumbed the lipstick print off Marpessa's angry forehead.
"And tell that class oppression garbage to the fucking Indians and the dodo birds. Talking about, I should know better. She's Jewish. She should know better."
"She didn't say she was Jewish. She said people think she looks Jewish."
"You're a fucking sellout.
That's why I fucking dumped your ass. You never stick up for yourself. You're probably on her side.
Godard approached filmmaking as criticism, the same way Marpessa approached bus driving. But in any case, I thought Laura Jane had a point. Whatever Jewish people supposedly look like, from Barbara Streisand to the nominally Jewish-ish Whoopi Goldberg, you never see people in commercials that look Jewish, just as you never see black people that come off as urban and hence scary, or handsome Asian men, or dark-skinned Latinos. I'm sure these groups spend a disproportionate amount of their incomes on shit they don't need. And of course, in the idyllic world of television advertisement, homosexuals are mythical beings. But you see more ads featuring unicorns and leprechauns than you do gay men and women. And maybe non-threatening African-American actors are overrepresented on television. Their master's degrees from the Yale School of Drama and Shakespearean training have gone to waste as they stand around barbecue pits delivering lines like, "Prithee, homeboy, forsooth, thou knowest that Budweiser is the king of beers. Uneasy lies the frothy head that wears the crown." But if you really think about it, the only thing you absolutely never see in car commercials isn't Jewish people, homosexuals, or urban Negroes. It's traffic. The bus slowed as Marpessa leaned into a left turn that took us off the highway and down a hidden, winding service road. We crept past a limestone outcropping, a set of rickety wooden coastal access stairs, and through an unused parking lot. From there, she downshifted, threw the bus in gear, and dune-buggied the vehicle directly onto the sand, where she parallel parked with the horizon and, since the tide was up, in about a foot and a half of seawater. "Don't worry. These things are like all-terrain vehicles and damn near amphibious. Between the mudslides and L.A.'s shitty sewage system, a bus has to be able to slog through anything. If we'd used metro buses to land on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, World War II would have ended 2 years earlier." The doors, both back and front, flew open, and the Pacific lapped lovingly at the bottom stairs, turning the bus into one of those Bora Bora hotel rooms that sit on pylons 50 yards out to sea. I half expected to see a jack-in-the-box service rep pull up on a jet ski delivering towels and a second round of sourdough burgers and vanilla shakes. Al Green was singing about love and happiness. Laura Jane stripped naked. In the dim interior light, her thin, smooth, pale skin was as iridescent as the nacre interior of an abalone shell. She strutted past us. "I played a mermaid in a tuna commercial once. However, I have to say there was no black talent on that shoot. How come there aren't any African-American mermaids?" "Because black women hate to get their hair wet."
"Oh."
And with that, using the bus's aluminum latticework like a stripper working the pole, she flung herself into the water. Followed by the jack-in-the-box crew, also naked, except for their paper hats. Hominy sidled up to the front and looked longingly at the water.
"Master, are we still in Dickens?"
"No, Hominy, we aren't."
"Well, where is Dickens then? Out there past the water?"
"Dickens exists in our heads. Real cities have borders and signs and sister cities."
"Will we have all that soon?"
"I hope so.
And, Massa, when we gonna get my movies from Foy Cheshire?"
"Soon as we reestablish Dickens. We'll see if he has them, I promise."
Hominy paused at the doorway and, fully clothed, tested the water with the toe of his brogans.
"You know how to swim?"
"Uh-uh. Don't you remember going deep-sea fishing?"
I'd forgotten about that macabre Little Rascals classic. The gang plays hooky from school and ends up on a fishing trawl sent out to catch a shark that's been terrorizing the waterfront. Since Pete the Pup has eaten the bait, they smear Little Hominy in cod liver oil, prick his finger, and hook his belt loop to the end of a fishing rod, lower him into the water, and use him as shark chum. While underwater, he has to suck the air out of a school of pufferfish to keep from drowning.
An electric eel repeatedly zaps him in the groin. The episode ends with a giant octopus showing its appreciation for the little rascals. Ridding the sea of the fanged menace, turns out Alfalfa's singing voice is so shrill he can carry a shark repellent note underwater, by spraying the boys in black ink. When the dinge-colored bunch return home to a jetty full of concerned parents, Hominy and Buckwheat's do-ragged mammy blurts out,
"Buckwheat, I done told yo pappy I ain't taking care of none of his other children."
My Bessa fell asleep in my lap, and I stared out into the ocean, listening to the breaking surf and the peals of laughter. But mostly I was transfixed by Laura Jane's shimmering pink coral nakedness backstroking through the ocean, nipples pointing to the stars, pubic hair sashaying in the clear water like a ginger tuft of silken seagrass. A scissor kick, a teasing glimpse, and she was underwater. Marpessa socked me hard in the ribs. It took all my willpower not to give her the satisfaction of rubbing out the pain. "Look at you, fiendin' for some white bitch like every other L.A. nigger. White babes don't do nothing for me. You know that. Bullshit. Your fucking hard-on woke me up. Aversion therapy. What's that?" I balked at telling her about my father locking my head into the tachistoscope and for 3 hours flashing split-second images of the forbidden fruit of his era. Pin-ups and Playboy centerfolds in my face. Betty Page, Betty Grable, Barbara Streisand, Twiggy, Jane Mansfield, Marilyn, Sophia Loren. Then he'd force Ipecac and okra smoothies down my throat. I'd vomit my guts out while he blasted Buffy St. Marie and Linda Ronstadt on the stereo. The visual stimuli worked, but the auditory stuff didn't take. To this day, whenever I'm feeling down and troubled, I crank Ricky Lee Jones, Joni Mitchell, and Carole King from the stereo, all of who were shouting out California way before Biggie, Tupac, or any of the Ice Coons. But if you look carefully, and the light is just right, you can see the after images of Barbie Benton's naked centerfold burned into my pupils as if they were discount plasma TVs. "It's nothing. I just don't like white girls, is all." Marpessa sat up and nestled her head into the crook of my neck. "Bonbon?" She smelled like she always did, of baby powder and designer shampoo. It was all she needed. "When did you fall in love with me?" "The color of burnt toast," I said, naming the best-selling memoir about the guy from Detroit with a crazy white mother who didn't want her biracial children to be traumatized by the word black, so she raised them as brown, called them beige-aloids, celebrated Brown History Month, and until he was 10 years old grew up believing that the reason he was so dark was because his absentee father was the lightning-scorched magnolia tree in the housing project courtyard. "You let my father convince you to join the Dum Dum Donuts book club. Everybody else loved the book, but during the question and answer session, you went off on dude. I'm so fucking tired of black women always being described by their skin tones. Honey-colored this, dark chocolate that. My paternal grandmother was mocha-tinged, cafe au lait, graham fucking cracker brown. How come they never describe the white characters in relation to foodstuffs and hot liquids? Why aren't there any yogurt-colored, eggshell-toned, string-cheese-skinned, low-fat-milk white protagonists in these racist, no-third-act-having books? That's why black literature sucks." I said, "Black literature sucks?" "Yep." And I was head over heels. Shit. White people got complexions, too.
A surprisingly strong swell rocked the bus from side to side. In the glow of the headlights, I spotted an outsider forming to the left. I kicked off my sneakers and socks, tore off my shirt, and swam out to meet it. Marpessa stood in the doorway, shin deep in the rising tide, her hands cupped around her mouth so that she could be heard above the crashing waves and the howl of a steadily increasing south-by-southwest wind.
Don't you want to know when I fell in love with you?
As if she were ever in love with me.
I fell in love with you every time we went out to eat. I'd say to myself, thank God, a black man who doesn't insist on sitting facing the door. Finally, a nigga who doesn't have to pretend that he's a big man, that has to be on guard at all times because somebody might be after him because he's so fucking bad. How could I not fall in love with you?
The key to body surfing a good wave is timing. Wait for the exact moment the tide drops the pit of your stomach into your groin. Swim 2 strokes ahead of the curl, and as soon as the current makes you feel weightless, make 2 more hard strokes. Lift your chin, throw 1 arm tight to your side and the other straight out in front, palm down and slightly bent at the elbow. Then just ride to shore.
City Lights, an interlude. I never understood the concept of the sister city, but I'd always been fascinated by it. The way that these twin towns, as they're sometimes known, choose and court each other seems more incestuous than adoptive. Some unions, like that of Tel Aviv and Berlin, Paris and Algiers, Honolulu and Hiroshima, are designed to signal an end to hostilities and the beginning of peace and prosperity. Arranged marriages in which the cities learn to love one another over time. Others are shotgun weddings, because one city, for example Atlanta, impregnated the other, for example Lagos, on a first date that spun violently out of control centuries ago. Some cities marry up for money and prestige. Others marry down to piss off their mother countries. Guess who's coming to dinner? Kabul! Every now and then, two cities meet and fall in love out of mutual respect and a love for hiking, thunderstorms, and classic rock and roll. Think Amsterdam and Istanbul, Buenos Aires and Seoul. But in the modern age, where your average town is too busy trying to balance budgets and keep the infrastructure from crumbling, most cities have a hard time finding a soulmate, so they turn to Sister City Global, an international matchmaking organization that finds love partners for lonely municipalities. It was 2 days after Hominy's birthday party, and although I and the rest of Dickens was still hungover when Miss Susan Silverman, city match consultant, called about my application, I couldn't have been more excited.
Hello. We're happy to have processed your application for International Municipal Sisterhood, but we can't seem to find Dickens on the map. It's near Los Angeles, right?
We used to be an official city, but now it's kind of occupied territory, like Guam, American Samoa, or the Sea of Tranquility.
So you're near the ocean?
Yes, an ocean of sorrow.
Well, it doesn't matter that you're not a recognized city. Sister City Global has paired communities before. For instance, Harlem, New York's sister city is Florence, Italy, because of their respective renaissances. Dickens hasn't had a renaissance, has it?
No. We haven't even had a single day of enlightenment.
That's too bad. But I do wish I'd known you were a coastal community, because that makes a difference. But, as it were, I ran your demographics through Urbana, our matchmaking computer, and it came back with 3 prospective sisters.
I grabbed my atlas and tried to guess who would be the lucky ladies. I knew better than to expect Rome, Nairobi, Cairo, or Kyoto, but figured second-tier hotties like Naples, Leipzig, and Canberra were definitely in play.
Let's see. Your 3 sister cities in order of compatibility, Juarez, Chernobyl, and Kinshasa.
Well, I didn't quite understand how Chernobyl had made the cut, especially since it's not even a city. At least Juarez and Kinshasa were 2 major municipalities with global profiles, if not besmirched reputations. But beggars can't be choosy.
We'll accept all 3, I shouted into the phone. That's all well and good, but I'm afraid all 3 have rejected Dickens.
What?
Why? On what grounds? Juarez, a.k.a. the city that never stops bleeding, feels that Dickens is too violent. Chernobyl, while tempted, felt that, in the end, Dickens' proximity to the Los Angeles River and sewage treatment plants was a problem, and questioned the attitudes of a citizenry so laissez-faire about such rampant pollution. And Kinshasa, of the Democratic Republic of the Congo?
Don't tell me. Kinshasa, the poorest city in the poorest country in the world, a place where the average per capita income is one goat bell, two bootleg Michael Jackson cassette tapes, and three sips of potable water per year, thinks we're too poor to associate with.
No, they think Dickens is too black. I believe them backward American niggers ain't ready, is how they put it.
Too embarrassed to tell Hominy that my efforts to find Dickens' a sister city had failed, I stalled him with little black lies. Gdansk is showing some interest, and we're getting feelers from Minsk, Kirkuk, Newark, and Nyack. Eventually I ran out of cities that ended in K or any other letter, and in a show of disappointment, Hominy turned over a plastic milk crate, placed it in the driveway, and placed himself on the auction block. Shirt off, breasts drooping, standing next to a sign hammered into the lawn, for sale, pre-owned Negro slave, only beaten on Thursdays, good conversation piece. He stayed there for over a week. Leaning on the horn wouldn't budge him from his perch, so whenever I needed to use the car, I'd have to yell, "Look out, man! Quakers!" Or, "Here comes Frederick Douglass and those damn abolitionists! Run for your lives!" which would send him ducking into the corn stalks for cover. But the day I needed to drive out to meet my apple tree connection, he was being especially stubborn.
"Hominy, can you get your ass out of the way?"
"I refuse to toil for no massa who can't manage a simple task such as finding a sister city. And today, this here field nigger refuses to move."
"Field nigger? Not that I want you to, but you don't do a lick of work. You spend your time in the jacuzzi. Field nigger my ass, you're a goddamn hot tub sauna banana daiquiri nigger. Now move."
In the end, I decided on three sister cities, each, like Dickens, a real municipality that disappeared under dubious circumstances. The first was Thebes, not the ancient Egyptian city, but the immense silent movie set from Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. Built to scale and since 1923 buried under the massive Nipomo dunes along the beaches of Guadalupe, California. Its massive wooden gates, hypostyle temples, and papier-mâché sphinxes served as home to Ramses and a phalanx of centurion and legionnaire extras. Maybe one day an offshore storm will uncover it and dust it off so that Moses can lead the Israelites back into Egypt and Dickens into the future. Next, the thriving, invisible city of Dickens formed sisterhoods with two more municipalities, Dollersheim, Austria, and the lost city of white male privilege. Dollersheim, a long-since vaporized village in northern Austria, just a grenade's throw from the Czech border, was the birthplace of Hitler's grandfather on his mother's side. Legend has it that right before the war, the Führer, in an effort to erase his medical history, one testicle, nose job, syphilis diagnosis, and ugly baby picture at a time, his original surname, Schickelgruber Busch, and his Jewish bloodline, had his crack troops prove their crackness by bombing the town back into the First Reich. As a historical erasure, it was quite an effective tactic, because no one knows anything definitive about Hitler other than he was the quintessential asshole, humorless, and a frustrated artist, though you could say that about almost anyone. There was a bit of a silent bidding war from ghost towns around the world for the honor of being Dickens's third sister city. The abandoned Varosha district, a once vibrant high-rise section of Famagusta, Cyprus, evacuated during the Turkish invasion and never demolished or repopulated, made an exciting pitch. We also received a stunning bid from Bokor Hill Station, the unsettled French resort settlement whose Rococo ruins continue to this day to rot in the Cambodian jungle. After an impressive presentation, Krakatoa, east of Java, was a front-runner. War-torn and evacuated towns like Oradour-sur-Vayres in France, Paua
and Gorouma in the Central African Republic all made strong pushes for civic sisterhood. But in the end, we found it impossible to ignore the impassioned pleas of the lost city of white male privilege, a controversial municipality whose very existence is often denied by many, mostly privileged.